News of the Times. Frightful Fridays. Stories of inconvenient in-laws. Welcome to News of the Times. In today's episode, we look at two cases where the in-law is murdered as they just seem to be in the way. In the first case from 1839, Charles Samuel Bartlett, a showman working with the travelling fair, has met a young girl, scarcely 18. They meet on the 10th of August and marry on the 16th. The young girl brings with her a dowry of £45, worth approximately £5,800 in 2024. Upon the death of her mother, he will be given a further £50. Less than 1 month later, the mother-in-law is surprisingly shot at in an ambush from behind within 20 minutes of having met up with her son-in-law. Our second case takes place in the peaceable community of Anglesey, North Wales, in 1869. 72-year-old successful farmer Richard Williams has living with him his widowed daughter and her many children. The daughter remarries a man of known bad character, Richard Rowlands, 45, a sometimes labourer and casual railway worker. Williams does not approve of his daughter's choice of husband and bans him from living on his extensive property. Rowlands is given a time limit in which to remove himself, his wife and the children from the farm and find another place to live. Shortly after, Williams is brutally attacked with a hammer as he is walking home from a neighbouring farm at night, an unprecedented crime in the quiet and safe community of Anglesey. Two stories of inconvenient in-laws standing in the way of fortunes is today's episode of Frightful Fridays. We hope you enjoy the show. Case 1. Charles Samuel Bartlett, 1839. Background. Samuel Bartlett, who married under the name of Charles Samuel Bartlett, was described as a rather good-looking, light-complexioned young man with something of the rakish appearance which attaches to persons of his profession. He is unusually dressed in a blue coat with a velvet collar and figured metal buttons, green striped handkerchief, plaid waistcoat and brown plaid trousers. He is a native of London. His wife, who remains unnamed in the news reports and in the Newgate calendar, was only just 18 years old. It was noted that she had been in service in Bath. The pair first met at the Lancet Fair, where the prisoner was performing on the 10th of August, and on the 16th of August they were married at Monmouth. The mother of the young bride and victim was a 45-year-old Mary Lewis. She was married to a shoemaker. From the Newcastle Calendar, 1837, the prisoner was a young man of decent parentage and education, but of a somewhat dissipated disposition, and he had followed a wandering life as a member of a strolling company of players called Ingleby's Company, frequenting fairs, racecourses, and other such places of entertainment. In the month of August, 1836, he visited Monmouth with his troop, and having become acquainted with the daughter of a shoemaker named Lewis, he was married to her. The prisoner represented to his wife's parents that he was by trade a cabinet maker. He received £45 as her wedding portion, and at the time of the marriage, and his wife, was entitled to £50 more on her mother's decease. After a short sojourn with his wife's friends, he proceeded to join his party. The crime. The crime took place in Bristol in broad daylight. Having invited his mother-in-law to a local pub for a chat and a friendly drink, he then borrowed a knife from staff, excused himself, went outside, and started whittling a stick he had found. He returned to the table where his mother-in-law was waiting, finishing their drinks. They left onto a remote pathway. Mary Lewis, Barrett's mother-in-law, was shot from behind in her head within 20 minutes of their departure on a lonely, isolated path. From the Newgate Calendar, 1837, on the 5th of September, hearing that her daughter and son-in-law were at Bristol, Mrs. Lewis went to see them, and she visited them there repeatedly, the prisoner being engaged in the usual manner in attending the fair. On the 9th of September, Bartlett was seen in the possession of a horsed pistol, and he sent a boy to purchase powder and percussion caps, and the boy saw him roll up a piece of lead in the form of a bullet. Previously to this, he and his mother-in-law had some difference, but on Saturday, the 10th of September, they quitted his lodgings together and were seen walking on the Stapleton Road. They entered the Mason's Arms and partook of some refreshment, and while there, Bartlett borrowed a knife from the landlady, saying that he wanted to cut a piece of wood. He went out to the backyard with it, where the firewood was kept, and on his return to the house, he was observed to be agitated, and he strove to conceal his features. Having then paid for the liquor which they had had, he and Mrs. Lewis went away, and they were seen to turn down a place called Tebbutt's Lane, leading towards the River Frome. Soon afterwards, a shot was heard, and within an hour, the murdered body of Mrs. Lewis was discovered stretched out on the ground. Her dress was disordered, her bonnet and shawl had been torn from her person, and one of her legs was found doubled up under her, as if in the agonies of death. She was instantly conveyed to the Mason's Arms, and upon an examination of her person, she was found to have been shot through the back of her head, the ball having passed through her bonnet. The crime is considered tremendously shocking. It occurs in broad daylight, and there is no attempt to hide the body, which is found within 30 minutes of its execution. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836, horrible murder at Stapleton. It is our unpleasant duty to record the perpetration of a most horrid murder which was committed on Saturday last at Stapleton between 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The unhappy victim was a respectable woman of about 45 years named Mary Lewis, the wife of a shoemaker, residing at Monmouth, and the suspected murderer is her son-in-law, a young man who has been travelling as a strolling player, and who was engaged at Ingleton's show in our last fair. His name is Samuel Bartlett, and he appears to be about 21 or 22 years of age. The motive, as far as we can learn, was a small sum of money, £50, which his wife would become entitled to at the decease of her mother. The scene of the murder was Lippitt's Lane, the entrance to which is about 100 yards beyond the Mason's Arms. It is a very narrow passage with a wall from 8 to 9 feet high on the one side and a steep bank surmounted by a hedge on the other. For concealment, the murderer could scarcely have fixed upon a more unlikely situation, as the body is sure to be seen by the first person who should happen to pass by. Consequently, the discovery was made within half an hour of the commission of the deed, and a great sensation was immediately produced throughout the village. The corpse was removed to the Mason's Arms, whither, in the course of the afternoon, crowds were attracted by the curiosity to view it, and it was recognised as being that of a female who had been there in the company of a young man and had left at about 2 o'clock. The body remains unidentified until Bartlett arrives and theatrically proclaims, "It is my mother-in-law." However, His appearance, with his distinctive showman's clothing and distinctive showmanship style, is immediately identified by several witnesses as, from a timeline perspective, most likely to have been the last person to see his mother-in-law, Mary Lewis, alive. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836. Horrible murder at Stapleton. No clue, however, was obtained of the murderer until the following day, Sunday, when the individual now in custody went to the public house and claimed the body as that of his mother-in-law. He was immediately recognised as the person who was with the deceased on the Saturday afternoon and who had left the house with her only a short time before the murder was committed. He was immediately taken into custody and carried before Mr. Ricketts, Esquire, and the Reverend Mr. Meyerhouse, magistrates, and the proper steps for holding an inquest on the body were taken. An inquest is held 2 days later. Meanwhile, the authorities have been active in finding as many witnesses as possible and to create the timeline of events. The witnesses who are brought forward to give testimony include a colleague who works within the fair who knows Bartlett and has recently met the mother-in-law, Mary Lewis. Robert Davis, who lived nearby and had discovered the body, he was able to give a general time when he had heard a shot. The landlady of the Mason's Arms, where Bartlett and Mary Lewis had gone in for a drink. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836, the horrible murder at Stapleton. Harriet Bedford, landlady of the Mason's Arms, deposed, "On Saturday last, between 1 and 2 o'clock, the deceased came to my house in the company with a young man. She had on a light muslin dress, dark shawl with border and straw bonnet. The young man ordered 2 small glasses of gin and water, which were taken into the parlour. On going there, I observed something peculiar about his manner, and thinking to make him speak, I made some remark about the weather. I said it was a stormy day, but he made no reply. He had 3 rings on his fingers." The witness here pointed to the prisoner and said, "The young man sitting at the bottom of the table is the person that was with the deceased." She continued, "He did not seem very cheerful, as people generally are when they come into a public house. He borrowed a knife of the servant girl, but did not say what he wanted it for. I believe he cut a stick with it. He went to the backyard and made use of it. When he put the knife down on returning from the yard, he thanked me for it, and I observed a notch in it, but I cannot say whether it was there before." Her evidence is crucial, not just to confirm the association within the hour between the two, but the use of the knife and twig. The reason for the stick cut down to size would be its potential to use to ram down a lead ball down the barrel of a pistol. Normally, they would be loaded with a lead ball wrapped in paper or a bit of cloth, which would then be pushed down by a rod. But an appropriate size stick could be used as well.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ah, it worked. Hello, there you are. Andrew here, and this is Shandor.
Hello!
We've got a brand new season of the Family Histories podcast for you with another 7 fascinating guests who'll be telling us about their secretive granny, a brave sailor, a political poet, a merchant seaman, a priestly lover, a resistance member, and a magnificent aunt that they've discovered in their family trees. And did I mention that there's a secret time machine? Nope, of course I didn't. Anyway, search for the Family Histories podcast after this episode to join us on our trip back in time. Okay, you can switch it off now.
The next witness is the waitress who had served Bartlett and Mary Lewis in the Mason Arms. She confirmed his long delay outside And once he had borrowed a knife and is having returned it with a stick in his hands, and their short departure afterwards. The next witness is the police sergeant investigating the crime. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836, the horrible murder at Stapleton. Thomas Walton, sergeant number 4, deposed, having heard that the body of a woman supposed to be murdered was lying at the Mason's Arm, I came here at about 9 o'clock on Saturday evening, and hearing it was someone connected with the shows, I made inquiries and found that a person answering the description of Bartlett lived at number 23 Barton Street. I and another sergeant, number 8, went to the house and searched it. In the prisoner's room were 3 boxes containing 2 pairs of trousers, coats, etc. In one of the boxes, which was locked, we found the horse pistol and under it this pocket pistol. The pistol was a very neat double-barreled pocket percussion pistol, about 6 or 7 inches long. We took away the pocket pistol, both barrels of which appeared to have been recently discharged. In one of the pockets of the trousers, and also in the pocket of the brown coat, we found a small quantity of fine paper. I had heard that a boy had purchased powder for him. This piece of stick was in his waistcoat on the bed. The stick was a piece which had been rounded about 6 inches long, and on being applied fitted the barrels of the pistol. It also appeared rather black and as if with powder. The inquest ends with the medical testimony concerning the injuries sustained by Mary Lewis in the attack upon her. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836, horrible murder at Stapleton. Dr. Alloway deposed, I was at the Mason's Arms on Saturday afternoon and saw the body of the deceased who had died in consequence of a gun or pistol shot wound in the head. I have this day examined the head more minutely, and I found 8 shots, some of them partially flattened, on the posterior external part of the skull. 4 other shots had penetrated beyond the base bone of the skull and the upper vertebrae of the neck and had lodged in the brain. The instrument must have been held close to the head. I found 12 shot altogether. There may have been more. I have no doubt this was the cause of her death. The verdict of the coroner's inquest. Given the tight timelines, location, the gun found in his room, the all-important stick and the several witnesses, the inquest jury finds Bartlett guilty. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836, horrible murder at Stapleton. The room was then cleared of all except the jury, who remained in deliberation about 30 minutes. At the expiration of that time, we were again admitted, and the prisoner was brought in. When the coroner addressed him, said it was his painful duty to inform him that the jury had felt they could come to no other conclusion than that of finding a verdict of willful murder against him, and the prisoner was then removed. The greatest interest was excited during the progress of the inquest. Several of the 100 people were assembled about the house whilst the inquest was going on. The deceased's shawl ribbons from her bonnet and down were found in a pond in the neighbourhood, covered over with some stones by police. Bartlett is taken to the county prison at Lawford, and then moved to Gloucester. The inquest is eagerly watched by crowds of people. Within jail, looking for support, as he continuously, vociferously proclaims his innocence, he sends a letter to his wife, a copy of which is made by the prison officials. From the Bristol Mercury, the 17th of September, 1836, the horrible murder at Stapleton. The following is a copy of a letter addressed by the prisoner to his wife on Thursday evening last. Dear wife, I entreat of you to set aside the past and confine yourself to the present awful situation. You are well aware I have no friend near to assist me. I therefore call upon you, as in duty bound, to render me all the assistance in your power. If you can possibly remain here till next week to see my mother, do so. Were I guilty of the dreadful crime I am charged with, I know not what would be my sufferings. My brain seems bewildered. I much wish to see your poor distracted father, and trust he will not leave without. I call upon you, by all the tender feelings of a wife, if you have any, by every tie, sacred, human, and divine, not to desert your husband in this trying hour. However, time is precious. I therefore conclude begging to be kindly remembered with every sentiment of affection to your unhappy father, and believe me, ever your affectionate, truly innocent, and falsely accused, unhappy husband, Samuel Bartlett. If you have the slightest regard for me, do not take those things to Monmouth. It seems that Bartlett thought his winning charm and showmanship would convince all of his innocence, despite the preponderance of evidence against him. We have not found evidence of the father going to see Bartlett, despite his pleas as he mourns the loss of his wife. The trial takes place in April and recounts in detail the evidence that had been given in the coroner's inquest. Bartlett seems strangely confident during the trial, as if he is unable to believe that anyone would think that he would have committed such a wicked deed. He has no defence other than to repeat his innocence. From the Bristol Mercury, 8th of April, 1837. Throughout the summing up, the prisoner seemed fidgety and uneasy, and he more than once appealed to a bystander and asked to the probable effect of the judge's observations. The colour which had attended him during that day forsake him, and his countenance betrayed a great anxiety. After an absence of 28 minutes, the jury returned into court, and their names having been called over, the clerk of indictments asked them if they had agreed upon their verdict, to which the foreman replied, "All guilty." The prisoner was at this time standing back from the bar with his eyes fixed attentively upon the jury. His first emotion seemed to be that of surprise, and he gazed vacantly for a few moments with his hands clasped together, and then burst into an almost hysterical smile, throwing open his arms, but gradually recovering himself and advancing forward. He leant his hands upon the bar and listened attentively to the clerk as he pronounced and recorded the verdict, still, however, smiling. The judge then put on the black cap and proceeded to address the prisoner in a solemn and impressive manner. "The murder you have committed, it is true, is not marked by many of the atrocities which often marked crimes of this description, but to my mind it is characterized by an atrocity of a deeper character. Sentence upon you is that you will be taken hence to the place from whence you came, from thence to the place of execution, where you are to be hanged by the neck till you are dead, and the Lord have mercy upon your soul." It is a curious coincidence that at the time the prisoner was receiving his sentence, his wife was prematurely delivered of a dead child in another part of the city, and by the very surgeon who had made the post-mortem examination of her mother. Charles Samuel Bartlett was executed on the 15th of April. To the last, Bartlett insisted upon his innocence. Upon the scaffold, he gave yet another long and rambling speech, exhorting the crowd of 5,000 to goodness, while exclaiming upon his clear conscience as an innocent man. Thus ended the short life of Charles Samuel Bartlett. Case 2, Richard Rowlands, 1861. Our next case involves Richard Rowlands, who was accused of beating his father-in-law to death in order to gain his farm. Background: Anglesey, North Wales, at the time enjoys a reputation of having had no known violent crimes in decades. It is a highly peaceful community where everyone knows everyone else. 45-year-old Richard Rowlands is a man of indifferent reputation. Although not educated in the standard sense of the word, he was able to read, and he was described as a quite intelligent man. A widower himself, he marries the recent widow of a prosperous farmer who has many children. The widow's father is greatly opposed to his daughter's choice of new husband and bans the new husband, Rowlands, from living on his premises. He eventually relents and allows him to live on the farm with his daughter, but he quickly changes his mind and insists that Rowlands and his daughter and numerous grandchildren must be off his property. He then gives him a deadline to leave, All Saints' Day, the 3rd of November, 1861, which is approaching quickly. The crime. 72-year-old farmer Richard Williams is reported to be a strong and healthy older gentleman. He is troubled by the marriage of his daughter to Rowlands and freely shares with friends and neighbours that he has ordered them off his property within a few weeks. On the evening in question, the day before the deadline given to Rowlands and his daughter to leave his property, Williams has walked to the neighbouring farm, said to be about a quarter of a mile from his own property, to discuss with the farmer there when he would be starting threshing. He remains there about 2 hours and then begins to walk back on the country lanes towards his house. He never arrives. From the North Wales Chronicle, the 9th of November, 1861, an atrocious murder in Anglesey. The committal of the prisoner for wilful murder. On Saturday morning last, the inhabitants of the usually quiet rural parish in Anglesey, distant about 6 miles from the Valley Station and on the Chester and Holyhead Railway, were thrown into the greatest possible state of consternation at the report of an old man aged 72, a respectable farmer in the district, having been found murdered in a ditch upon his own land and about 220 yards from his own house. From inquiries made by us on the spot, it appears that the deceased, Richard Williams, occupied a farm where also resided his daughter, until recently a widow with several children. Some months back, she married a man of the name of Richard Rowlands, a native of the neighbouring parish, who, it was said, had never borne a good character. Her father, the deceased, was decidedly against the match, and until lately had positively refused him admittance upon his premises. However, a short time ago he was unfortunately prevailed upon to allow him to reside there until All Saints, when, as the old man had told some of his neighbours, he, along with the wife and family, would have to leave. At about 6 o'clock on Friday evening, the fatal night in question, the deceased left home to proceed to a neighbouring farm to make some arrangements respecting a threshing machine. He remained there some couple of hours and left towards his own home along a path across the fields. The night was somewhat dark and stormy. On the following morning, he was found dead, lying in a puddle of water near a hedge, with marks of blood upon the ground, as well as upon the fence, which he had to go over in going towards his home. His head presented a dreadful spectacle, and upon examination was found to contain several wounds of a very serious nature, and to indicate unmistakably that his death had resulted from one of the foulest and most cold-blooded murders ever perpetrated. The temporal bone on one side was completely shattered and battered, with a fracture above the right ear extending to the base of the brain. It was not until Sunday morning that the police received information of the poor man's death. Immediately after, it was made known to Inspector Ellis. A very searching inquiry was instituted on the spot as to the cause of death, and ever since, the greatest possible vigilance has been evinced by the county force under the able direction of its active chief captain, Griffith, the result of which has been the apprehension of the said Richard Rowlands. Against him, as will be seen from the following report, a verdict of willful murder has been returned at the coroner's investigation. The prisoner is a middle-aged man and for some 2 or 3 months in the summer was employed as an extra hand at the Goods Department railway station in Holyhead. He appears to be a clever, shrewd fellow, and during the whole of the painful investigation he did not appear to betray the least emotion, although he seemed eager to catch at every observation made by the court and the witness. The inquest. The inquest was opened on Monday last at the Black Lion Public House before W. Jones, Esquire, Coroner, and a jury empanelled from amongst the most respectable farmers in the parish. The coroner's inquest. The inquest takes place with several witnesses brought forward to establish the relationship between Williams and his son-in-law, Rowlands, as well as the cause of death and, if the death was assessed as murder, who the likely culprit was. And the first witness examined was William Jones, farmer, who, on his oath, said, "I have known the deceased for several years. Between 7 and 8 o'clock on Saturday morning came Richard Rowlands, the deceased's son-in-law, who came to his place. I was at the time in the stable. He told me that the deceased was dead in the ditch and that he had fallen in. I asked him, 'Where is he?' He replied, 'At the bottom of the field.' I went immediately along with him to the spot and found the deceased lying on the side on the ground and his legs crossed. His feet were toward the ditch in a puddle of water and his head was lying in the direction of his farm. There was a good deal of blood near his head. I also observed blood on the hedge over which the deceased had to crawl on his way home. I have heard the deceased say that he was going to turn Rowlands and his family away at All Saints' Day, November the 3rd. He told me this sometime during the last corn harvest." The next witness was Owen Owen Sr., who deposed he knew the deceased for many years. He was at his farm at 6 o'clock on Friday evening last. He, Williams, came over to know when we were going to thrush. He remained in our house about 2 hours. I saw him start towards his home, going across the fields along the path. It was much nearer for him than the road. The distance between my home and his farm is not a quarter of a mile. There are 2 fields across from my house down to the boundary between his land and ours. I did not see him after that night. I heard no cries of distress, and he left the house between 8 or 9 in the evening." The next witness is Richard Roberts, aged 14, grandson of the deceased. He testifies of Rowlands living on the farm, but not actually working on the farm. In the night in question, he saw Rowlands, who stayed with him and some of the other children, as they supped. Rowlands then gave him some money so that he could attend a club in town. The next witness is the inspector in charge of the case, Inspector Ellis from Holyhead. "On Sunday evening at about 6, I first received information about the death of Richard Williams. Sergeant Parry told me first. As early as I could on Monday morning, I went to his farm. I reached there at about 12 at noon. The first thing I did was to examine the spot where the body was found. Sergeant Parry and Robert Griffith pointed out the place to me. I found on the top of the fence between the two farms considerable blood. I cut out the sod from off the fence, and within 4 inches to that spot I observed a hole in the fence which might have been done by a pickaxe or the point of a hammer. It had been a little trampled. There was some blood on the stones and also up on the ground. I searched the house and took Richard Rowlands with me upstairs. I asked him what bed he had slept in. He showed it to me. And under that bed I found a cloth waistcoat and another with sleeves which I now produce. I asked him if he had these on the Friday night in question. He said he had. I also asked him to take one shirt off. He wore two. It was the undermost, which I also produce. I searched further and found the jacket produced in a basket under some clothes, and I cannot undertake to swear that the mark on the clothes are marks of blood, but my impression is that they are blood. I searched the rest of the premises. I also found the hammer produced in the dairy. It is now in the same state as I found it. On Tuesday last, I searched the house again and found the trousers produced in a cupboard with some other dirty clothes. I apprehended Richard Rowlands on Monday and took him into custody. I told him what the charge against him was. He made no reply, but in about 20 minutes afterwards, he said he had nothing to do with it and said, "I don't believe that there was any enmity between anyone and the old man except William Jones Beinteg." He said nothing more when I told him I'd found another trousers with other marks on it. He said nothing to that. There is a mark on the right-hand side pocket. The last evidence given is the medical testimony. Mr. Edward Williams, surgeon, deposed, "I was at the farm on Monday last. I examined the body of the deceased. I first cut off his hair. The first wound I examined was a little above the right ear. It was about an inch and a half in length. It had not penetrated the bone, but below there was the depression of the temple bone. The right side of the temporal bone was shattered and completely battered in, injuring the dura mater to the depth of an inch. There is also a transfer fracture of the skull across from the right temple to the left side. In my opinion, the wounds could not have been affected by sharp instruments. They must have been inflicted by the sharp end as well as the blunt point of instruments similar to the hammer produced. I have no doubt they caused the death of the deceased." The coroner then addressed the jury. "It was a matter of great regret that Anglesey, the most peaceable county in England or Wales, should be stained with a foul deed of that nature. He believed there was little doubt that the poor man, Richard Williams, had been murdered, but the question was, by whom? In his opinion, it was impossible to bring the guilt home to any individual but the prisoner. There was no one else in the house with the full advantage of knowing where, when, and which way the old man was likely to return that could have done it except the prisoner." The court was then cleared, and the jury, after about half an hour's deliberation, returned a verdict of willful murder against Richard Rowlands. The prisoner did not seem to be much affected by the verdict, but two of his brothers who were present at the investigation, and who we believe are quite respectable men, appeared much shocked at the announcement of the verdict. The shock and the distress of the quiet community is palatable. There is much pressure to find the murderer of Richard Williams, who has quietly walked back to his farm and whose head was most likely severely beaten in with a hammer. As the trial date looms, the police do their utmost to tie together the timeline and evidence for the conviction of Richard Rowlands for the murder of his father-in-law. The trial. From the North Wales Chronicle, the 5th of April, 1862. Richard Rowlands. On Friday the 1st of November, Richard Williams left his house for a neighbouring farm, a distance of about 500 yards, where he remained smoking his pipe in his usual health and spirits for about 2 hours. About 8 o'clock, he proceeded towards home, which, however, he never reached alive. He was found the next morning lying in a ditch with his head dreadfully mutilated and in such a state that left no doubt on the minds of those who saw him that he had been most cruelly murdered by someone. Witnesses are brought forward showing that Rowlands had been in the house whilst Williams was visiting the neighbouring farm, that he had gone out unusually sometime between 8 and 9 in the evening, and that he had returned back to the farm around which corresponded to the time frame when Williams was known to be on his way home. Additionally, the clothes which he had worn and seemed to have been hidden were found with marks upon them that looked like blood. There is unsubstantiated testimony that Mrs. Rowlands, the daughter, had been seen washing his shirt sleeves after he had come, but this remains unproven. A hammer that had been used previously in the week is not located in its usual spot, but found instead with what looks like blood stains upon it. His attempt to cast suspicion upon a resident of Anglesey, with whom Williams had had some disagreement with, is proven categorically to be spurious. And, of course, there was the all-important question of motive. Rowlands, the daughter and the children had been told decidedly that they were to leave by All Saints' Day, the 3rd of November. The crime took place the evening before. It did not appear that Rowlands had found any kind of alternative accommodation for himself and his new family. From the North Wales Chronicle, the 5th of April, 1862, Richard Rowlands, for the murder of his father-in-law. The last act of the dreadful tragedy which has for several months past occupied in so powerful a manner the attention of the people of North Wales was brought to a close this Friday morning by the execution of the wretched man, Richard Rowlands. It is nearly 32 years since the quietude of the county of Anglesey was last disturbed by a public execution, 40 years having then intervened between that and the time when a similar event had taken place in that county. The prisoner was convicted at the late assizes for Anglesey of the wilful murder of Richard Williams, his father-in-law, an old man of 72 years of age, and a small farmer, occupying a farm called Garned in the parish of Clanfethlou. It was proved in evidence at the trial that, having ascertained that the old man had gone out at the time of night, the prisoner also left the house and returned just about the time when the murder was committed. From his own statements to the witness, his conduct after the recovery of the body and other facts detailed to the jury, they returned a verdict of guilty against the prisoner, after which the judge passed sentence of death in a most solemn and impressive manner. Subsequently, as we stated in our last edition, an attempt was made to procure for him an extension of the royal clemency, which, however, proved a failure. A communication was received from Sir George Grey, Secretary for the House Department, stating that, after careful examination of the evidence, he did not feel justified in advising Her Majesty to commute the sentence of death passed upon the prisoner. Richard Rowlands was the son of a small farmer in the parish of Anglesey and was 45 years of age. He was engaged for many years as a farm labourer by the neighbouring farmers and was, for a short time only last year, employed as an extra porter at the goods department railway station, Holyhead. About 4 months before this occurrence, he married the daughter of the old man, Richard Williams, she being a widow and himself being a widower, both having had several children. The deceased, Richard Williams, being displeased with this unhappy union, gave imperative orders that he should not be admitted under his roof, but subsequently allowed him occasionally to go there, with the understanding that they were to shortly leave for a house of their own. To prevent this, it was said, was the motive for perpetrating the foul deed with which the prisoner was charged, and for which he was made to suffer such an ignominious death as that witnessed at Beaumaris this day. He was able to read Welsh, but he was seldom ever seen in a place of worship. Without descending to notice the idle rumours, we may state, on the authority of those to whom he was best known, that his character through life was such as to render him an object to be shunned in society. From his conversation, it would appear that he was a man endowed with a clear intellect, and his knowledge of things and men in general decidedly superior to that of men of his class. He has left behind him a wife with several children, three brothers, and an aged mother, bedridden for many years. Workers from Chester arrive and rapidly build a scaffold, a terrible sight for the peace-loving community of Anglesey. On the day of the execution, hundreds pour in to view the spectacle. To the last, Richard Rowlands adheres to his claim of innocence. He is hung by Calcraft, and after the usual hour he is cut down and buried within the precincts of the jail. That concludes this episode of Frightful Fridays, Stories of Inconvenient In-Laws. We very much hope you enjoyed the show. If you did enjoy this show, we would be grateful if you could like or subscribe to our channel. We upload 5 days a week. Mondays are murderous as we delve into the dark side of Regency and Victorian crime. Wednesdays are wicked, where we pull together stories with a similar theme, such as Doctors of Death. Fridays are frightful, where we look at crimes in a location such as stories from the stage to murder and scandal in the aristocracy. Saturdays is Serial Killer Saturdays, where we investigate serial killer stories from the past. On the last Sunday of the month, we offer a 2-hour compilation of stories based around a theme. Thank you again for watching and listening. This has been News of the Times, and I am Robin Coles.